When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, Bingetown? How are we feeling today? As producer Dave would say, we are back for our coverage of Hulu's Shogun, episode 6, titled Ladies of the Willow World. We are on the other half of this season and the other half of this series. If you didn't know, it's just going to be one season. I'm very excited to talk about this, but of course, some Bingetown housekeeping items. As always, you can find us on socials at Bingetown TV, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, whatever it is, you can find us there. We're covering a bunch of different things, not just Shogun. So if this is your only exposure to us, go check out our main channel, Bingetown TV, and you'll see we recently did Avatar The Last Airbender and True Detective. We have The Bear and The Boys in the Chamber coming up in a couple months. House of the Dragon as well. Masters of the Air, Traitors, Survivor. So we're doing a bunch of different things. As always, there's going to be something that you like. Just go check out our main channel. So I don't want to delay us too much because there's a lot to talk about for this episode. My initial high level thoughts. Oh, by the way, we're missing one of our mainstays here, Jimmy. So it's just going to be a two-person podcast, me and Paul.
We didn't want him anyway. No, just kidding.
Exactly.
Jimmy will be missed.
He'll have some time to chime in the beginning of next podcast to kind of recap anything else that he wanted us to bring up. But for now, it's just me and Paul. So we're going to go through episode 6 and my high-level thoughts. Just initially, I'll say that I didn't think that this was my favorite episode after my first watch, but I really enjoyed it the second time through. It was just all character development for Lady Ochiba, getting her backstory. We really needed to establish her as a character and a presence if she's going to be the true big bad of the show. So that's a lot of this episode did the heavy lifting of just establishing her and connecting Mariko and how she really relates to Torunaga and her motivation. So all of that was good for me, and I really enjoyed it the second watch through. I don't know where I land on in terms of like if this is like a just right in the middle of the pack, but every single episode has been so good so far that it almost seems irrelevant to really rank it. It just was not bad at all. It was great. So how did you feel after your first and second watch through?
I totally agree in the aspect of that the second watch through, I picked up on so many more things. I mean, I loved it first watch through. It's so great to see the pairings and the conversations. You never know where it's going to go. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And how I felt on this episode, I loved it. When John and Mariko aren't, you know, lovey-dovey, kind of sucks. You know, I want them to be happy. So whenever they're button heads, it's not great. But so many other aspects, like you said, Lady Ochiba, this was her episode. She is so terrifying for having done like so little. Like, we'll get into it. She doesn't really do anything. She's been through a lot, but she says the right things. So she's awesome. I love her introduction to the cast. Puts a whole other spin on everything. This episode, we'll talk about it, but man, it's just so flipped from what it used to be. I loved it. I'm so ready to just jump in.
Yeah, I'm like convincing myself more and more after seeing some of the dialogue online and just rewatching the season multiple times. I think she's perfect as a final villain, if that's the route we're going to really take. Because the more I think about Ishido, he's kind of incompetent in comparison to Torunaga. It doesn't seem like he'll ever have the edge over Torunaga by himself. But throwing Ochiba into this really adds some power to the bad guy side, if we want to look at it like that. So yeah, this was such a needed episode. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy that they went through and did it now instead of waiting till like episode 8 or 9, where we kind of just want all action from here on out. And I'm thinking going forward, we're going to get a couple huge war scenes. Crimson Sky is happening. So I think it's just going to be go, go, go from here on out. Because what other backstory do we need to establish? We have Mariko's for the most part. Achiba's is there. Maybe a little bit more on Torunaga's backstory and how he's really connected to all of the killing of the last Taiko, Kuroda, which is Ochiba's dad, we learned in this episode. Or maybe we already knew that, but I just didn't have that in my family tree that she was the daughter of the previous emperor. Did we already know that?
I don't think I did. Okay. They might have mentioned it, but it wasn't clear to me. So when they really laid it out for me this episode, I felt like I needed it. So I'm kind of glad they did it. They did it perfectly. They didn't linger on anything. But yeah, the first scene just being jumped back in what, 22 years ago. I love a good flashback, man. It just helps lay the groundwork and everything. So,
yeah. So while you're mentioning it, let's just start going through it, because the buckets of this episode are pretty isolated. We have the Osaka Lady Ochiba storyline, and then everything else that's still happening with Torunaga and JB John Blackthorne. So we're going to keep going in the same vein that you just mentioned right there. 22 years ago, Azuchi Castle, that pronunciation is probably wrong. Either way, the important part of this flashback is to show Mariko's connection to Ochiba. They were childhood best friends. They grew up together. They learned politics together. You saw Mariko have that little time skip where she was training and like fighting together. So they really were childhood best friends. And that's something I didn't see really playing into her backstory, Mariko's, that is. I'm happy it's more connected like this because it really adds more layers for Mariko as a character. But this is everything I could have wanted for Ochiba, to make her central to the plot and how she is connected to this whole ruling regiment and why she even is respected at all amongst the councilmen of regents, because she was royalty before the last Taiko. And I guess by being the concubine of the last Taiko, she continued her royal status. So she's just a very important person, and it feels like she's grounded in everything that we know now after this flashback. And we could just talk about whatever you want for the flashback.
The highlight was, yeah, Mariko for me. She's just amazing, especially when she whips out the spear. We kind of learn about her and Buntaro a little bit, like how their marriage was first looked upon by both of them. She didn't like it at all and thought that Buntaro, or the Toda clan, actually was a useless ally. But you're totally right, dude. With all the lady, well, I guess she was Ruri back then, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that was going to be a thing, with that her and Margo were going to be best friends. So I am so excited for their first interaction together, what that's going to be like, because they both kind of reminisced on those days with like fond memories before all the tragedy happened for Lady Ochiba. So it kind of seems like if anybody can maybe reel Lady Ochiba back, it's probably already too late. She's already done too much. But if somebody could, maybe it would be Mariko. But
I'm picturing like an anime clash, like they're going to square up, eyes, just no words, and
Yeah, used to be buddies, now enemies. No, totally. I could see that coming up.
So I want to bring up all the stuff with Mariko's father, Jinzai. I don't know if what name we should be calling him, but I like the name Jinzai. It sounds like Jinzo. Shout out Yu-Gi-Oh! So I'm gonna just keep calling him Jinzai. He's established as not just a high up in the regiment of Kuroda's rule. He was like one of the top advisors, one of the top generals, and that's how this whole storyline came together and why Mariko is even being introduced to Ochiba or Ruri at the time. But he has a moment, and I probably caught it the first time, but I really thought about it the second time, where you're seeing some of the seeds being planted of why Jinzai were like clashing, and where he eventually goes on to kill and murder Kuroda. We see Torunaga grabbing him and stopping him, and he says the line, "Now is not the time." And now I'm thinking, how crazy would this show be if it turns out that Torunaga is just this schemer that's like had this decades long plan to somehow end up as being the Shogun, because he keeps saying he doesn't want to be Shogun, but everything like in his actions is getting him closer to that goal. And now we're seeing that Ochiba's entire motivation of why she is anti Torunaga and wants to kill him and think he's coming for the heir is because she says that he was basically whispering in the ear of all the political members and planting these seeds to where he could take over. It's probably being paranoid on her side because Torunaga is the goat, but also that little line right there implies that he was plotting for a little bit, but who knows?
The way Lady Ochiba talks about Torunaga, he knew that he did something, but she makes him sound evil, and like she makes it sound like he is this, I don't know, straight up murderer, which obviously in our lens, he's the most loyal and honorable person ever. So that would be totally nuts. And just to reference for everybody listening, we know that this is based on history, but we have no idea of the outcome. We do not know the history at all. So We don't know what happened in that era in Japan. So like, we're not expecting some type of outcome. So we have no idea if Torunaga is going to live or die. Yeah, there was a lot of talk about him becoming Shogun this episode. So I was like, I feel like that's going to be it. I hope so. At least.
It's definitely going to be the end, is him just being Shogun. Like, it has to be. What are we doing here if it's not that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know the history, though. That'd be hysterical if he, like, famously dies.
I guess the main takeaway is that they did so much with so little screen time of Uchiha's backstory. I feel like I understand her completely. And that's like just good writing in a story like this, where she's introduced in the second half of the series as a main character. We get her whole backstory, and I feel like I know exactly why she's doing the things that she's doing. So in modern day, we see this being paralleled with the fact that she's basically having anything Torunaga related, all of his estates that he owns in Osaka being burned to the ground. She's really being openly anti-Torunaga for the first time. I know it's been Ishido who's been against Torunaga, but kind of like putting on that facade of like he's doing it for the empire. She's just outwardly like, we're going to kill him. And everything that's happening right now got pretty insane in Osaka. You saw like everything burning down, like his pigeons where he was getting all of his spy network information from. And then we even see Lady Shizu and Lady Kiri are going to have to stay in Osaka because I think it's because she was too pregnant. They're going to get caught. So their only chance of getting any information to Torunaga and like all the homies is sending Hiramatsu out there. And that's pretty much like the whole first half of the Osaka storyline is him escaping to go deliver the message and plan with Torunaga.
Yeah, how about him on horseback? Those old fighting instincts.
Catching a nice body.
Looked great watching him ride out. I'm super nervous for what's to come of his wife. Assume everybody left over in Osaka has just become certain prisoner / hostage, as they've been calling them.
And so let me ask you a question then. What do you think the leverage of having Lady Shizu's baby there? Like, is that even a thought in Torunaga's mind? Is that even worth, oh, okay, I'll surrender? Like, it's not anything, right?
No, I just think it could be brutal to, you know, Hiramatsu when he comes back, if he sees their dead bodies like crucified or something like that as like a warning sign. It's just, Yeah, it's just more sadness more than like actual leverage in moving the plot.
And that could work because that could keep Uchiha being like evil in the eyes of the audience and Torunaga being pure good. He's got to go and redeem his family. I could see that happening. Definitely. I feel like we need to kill some characters because there hasn't been too many deaths. We do have, spoiler alert, Sugiyama dying at the end of this episode. But who was the last big character that we had actually murdered? Because Jozen wasn't that big a couple episodes ago either. I think we're about to start catching some bodies, and it could start with Torunaga's family that's in Osaka.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I honestly thought the ball was going to start rolling episode 2, when the assassin, Abuda, meat assassin, was sent to Torunaga. I thought that was going to be when bodies were dropping, but like big names, like now they're down two seats on the council, and what's Ishido going to do? He's just going to be like, all right, I'll just rule it now. We don't even need five anymore. Like, can he do that? Like, I don't know what the rules are at this point, and they would even follow him. They had a line later on this episode where Ishido has complete control over all of Osaka. Mm-hmm. And Torunaga says, I think it's him, says, unless the people like stand up and fight. But
and protest,
I don't see that being a thing. I'm like, how are they going to get organized and stuff? Ishido already had that planned and kept them hostages. So it was Lady Uchiha, I guess. I keep saying Ishido, but this is really, he's the one just doing the actions.
He's a puppet too, yeah.
All her plan. So she's the one. I think Martine had a line. He was like, ever since you got here, everything's accelerated. And yeah, that's 100% what's happened.
I mean, that's a good segue into that isolated scene of the Portuguese Catholics. Father Del Agua. That's what I haven't written down just because he'd said it the one time. I guess that's his name. He calls him My Eminence, so I know he's higher up in the church. But they're talking, and like you're saying, Father Martin is being reasonable and rational and strategic about what's actually happening. He goes on to say, we should probably think about allying with Torunaga because he's the reasonable side of this. And the other father says no, essentially. He just shuts it down and says that maybe we'll deal with it in the aftermath of whatever battle's going down. But they didn't want to insert themselves because all they care about is just having Catholicism win at the end of the day. They don't care what side, but I'm thinking Father Martin's ready to rally the troops and go back to Mariko's side, and we can just consider him an ally soon.
Yeah, I mean, he laid out all the points about why their partnership with Lady Uchiha would never work out. She basically hates the church. So he's like, hey, yeah, let's just jump ship and maybe we can get something out of it still if we just side with Torunaga. When he says that, I call him Big Papa because like Big Father, he's a higher up and stuff like that. So Big Papa is like, that man is a Minowara, Martine. Mm-hmm. So they like throw that around like it's such a stain on your soul. So I know we went into it a little bit and they're kind of like disgraced now.
From his perspective, what I was taking it as is if Aminowara is put onto the throne and becomes Shogun again, whatever, the leader, in his head, there's like no chance that Catholicism will come through because they're true blood Japanese heritage line that would probably stick to Buddhism or whatever their main religion is. I think that's kind of what he was hinting at. But Martin's just trying to make sure that whoever wins is like a reasonable person and doesn't want somebody willing to burn the whole city to the ground just to kill Torunaga, I think. But I'm reading into it a lot because they didn't say that much in this scene. It just feels like Big Papa is Father Papa, Big Papa, what'd you call him? Why didn't you say that earlier in the season? That's amazing.
Big Papa. Well, Big I called him yeah. Big Father and I was like, yeah, that's not as good. So we'll just go Big Papa.
I'm writing that down. I like Big Papa. Something's going to have to give there because they are not on the same page, Martin and Big Papa. So Martin just has too many good qualities, and it felt like in the beginning half of the season, he was being built up as to have some sort of role, because right now, they're just backseat. Like, I don't see how they even play into it unless he betrays Big Papa and goes to their to Torunaga's side, but I don't know. That could play in any way.
Yeah. They honestly showed up this episode, and I was like, oh, forgot about you guys. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen you in a while. So their deal about building a church in Edo, I'm sure that will come back into play at some point. Yeah. But yeah, I don't really see them being like key players like in Crimson Sky at all or anything like that. So,
especially because JB will never work with them. His whole thing is he hates the Portuguese. So I don't know how they would reconcile.
Sees their boat and almost pops a blood vessel in anger. Yeah. It's crazy. Lady Ochiba, when she goes back to now the Taiko, like her father's murdered, she goes to the Taiko. She's talking to Daoin, the wife of the Taiko, who can't produce an heir.
Yes, that's her name. She's been in the series already, remember? Yeah. I mixed her up for like the caretaker in the first episode, and I issued like a correction there. So like how everything plays out in Osaka is like they go to that play that Lord Ito is performing, and then we get all these isolated conversations and looks, and then we're jumping around a little bit. But yeah, what you're talking about is the first time that I didn't even write it down. What's her name?
Daoin or something like
Daoin.
That.
Okay, whatever. The previous like Taikoess. I don't even know what her title is. But yeah, that was a pretty good scene. Ochiba was special. I don't even know the right way to phrase it because she just like inserts herself and she goes on to later say in this episode that she basically just grabbed fate by the neck and said like, we're doing this. And she was the only one that could get pregnant from the previous Taiko, and she mentions like hundreds of concubines tried and nobody could do it, but she was the one. So what did you take from that conversation when she's given her the like, I'll give you this mirror if you can do this, this is a one of a kind thing?
Yeah, and then it went into like real quick to show like them putting the mushrooms in the tea and her taking it. So like I don't know if that played into it, but I think it was more just setting her up to become the mother of the heir. And then I don't know how she has all, like, Lady Ochiba has all this power. She's, like, the mother of the heir, but she's not in, like, a seat of power, right? Like, is she just kind of listening to her? So, what you were saying, she just kind of told fate or whatever, like, piss off. And that's her whole thing. She just goes out and takes it. She even had the line to Lord Ito. It was like, some are born under a banner of greatness and some need to go achieve it or take it. I'm butchering these quotes, and it's a shame because they're all beautifully put, and I do not copy them down correctly.
Yeah, I do think that Lady Taiko is the shit. She's been like an OG since day one, because that earlier conversation we got this season when she's talking to Torunaga, she has a good head on her shoulders. So I'm kind of scared for her because I feel like she's going to go against the agenda of being anti-Torunaga, and Ochiba might actually have her killed because it seemed like she was kind of hinting to her in this scene that she should be going against Ishido. She's picking the wrong ally. That to me is a little red flag. Like if Cersei hears those kind of things, she kills you. I feel like Ochiba might lean that way as well. So she could be an easy body because that will piss off Torunaga because she was a true friend to him. So that could work. I could see that being how this goes.
Yeah. And like you're saying, if you piss off Lady Ochiba, she's not waiting around for all the right hearings or decisions or votes. Like she's just killing people straight up. So we kind of get it right here because they asked Lord Ito to be in the council as the fifth seat. And Ishido saying that this is all of Lady Kiyama's idea. So when it goes to the actual vote, do we want to jump there or did I miss anything else?
I mean, the only other thing, we'll talk about that, I guess, in a second. I just want to bring up Sugiyama's rebellion starts here, the first conversation he has where he says it's the end of the realm, like I'm the only one actually going for the realm. And I would have bet $1 million that I would have never liked any of these regent councilmen, but he turns out to somehow be the good one, which we none of us predicted. We just thought they were all going to be under Ishida's thumb after Torunaga left, but it was cool that they have to basically replace another guy because he's the one that's not religious and he's just from one of the richest families in Japanese history. So he does care about the culture and stuff, and you see him talk about it in this play. But besides that, yeah, we can move over to like the actual vote itself when he is the only one, Sugiyama that is, that refuses to vote in Lord Edo as this like just talking head for Ishido.
Right after that, when he storms out, he's like, I'm the only one that actually serves this realm. He storms out and next scene is Ishido talking to Lady Ochiba saying, oh, we're going to impeach him. Like, don't worry. Then we'll get in the new council. We'll control. And she's like, when? He keeps saying this. Like, why don't you just do it now? So she doesn't wait for those votes. She's like, hey, dude, you want somebody that's in your way out of your way? You just got to kill him. So she, I guess, persuades Ishido to go out and stop Sugiyama as he's running through the woods with his family trying to escape. And yeah, they're dead. Definitely.
That was awesome because you're right. Like Ishido's been all plans and not enough results. So it's cool to see that other side of that in Ochiba getting shit done. She says the line in this conversation when she's convincing Ishido to go kill Sugiyama. His secret heart is no secret to me. And if you think back, I think it was episode 3 or 4. It was about the three hearts that every man has. I remember you really liked that quote.
Oh, yeah.
And she says, like, his third secret heart, his motivations deep down. She's saying it's not a secret to her because she thinks he was truly being conniving when Kuroda was alive. So I don't know if she's just misguided and using this as a way to gain power, or if she truly to her core believes this. And in that case, she Uzoma's justified in going crazy to do whatever she can to kill Torunaga. Either way, it's an interesting turn and it really makes her resolve like solid and sound. So they're painting her out to also be a thinker. I don't know if she's as good of a thinker as Torunaga, but she's definitely not just somebody that's doing things on whims. Like she has this whole plan thought through and she has all these reasons. So it's just cool to see her being built up at the same time that our good guys are taking all these hits, like with the earthquake and losing some of their army. They don't know what they're actually going to do, if they're going to retaliate or not. So like they're all babbling over here and she's just rallying everybody together into one side. So it really works when you're thinking about it from like a just strategic point of view.
She just like talks Torunaga up too. She's like, you guys have no idea who you're going up against. Like he's smarter than all of you. And I'm like, all right, like maybe we're not so screwed with half the army getting hurt. Maybe we're in a good position, because the way she just talks about him makes it like seem like a John Wick situation where like the bad guys are scared of this guy. So, and one other thing, when they showed Lord Sugiyama dead in the woods after they killed him and then blamed it on the bandits, I just want to give credit to how much effort they put in, because they show Sugiyama's hand cut in half, right?
Yeah.
And they didn't need to put that in there. It obviously cost money to CGI it in, but it tells like such a story, because that's like what would happen if you put up your hand to stop a blade from killing you, right? So just by putting that in there, it's telling such a story, and just the effort that they put into every scene. I mean, we'll get into the Kiku negotiation scene later, where I was like, first time watching, I'm like, this is whatever. Second time, I was like, wow, that's actually really cool.
You didn't hear that Sugiyama's a method actor? They actually cut his hand in half for that scene.
I respect that. It's like Shia LaBeouf ripping a tooth out because he thought his soldier would have a missing tooth. Love it.
I'm pretty sure that does it with everything Osaka-wise. Anything else that you can think of before we move on over to JB and Torunaga?
No, I think we covered it. I just don't know what's going to happen there now with another seat down, how the rest of the hostages are going to handle it.
If I have to guess, I think they're just going to put another figurehead. It's going to be Ono and Kiyama, still the Catholics. And then it's going to be Ito and this other person who are just figurehead voters for Ochiba. Mm-hmm.
And he's just
that's how I think it's going to be.
Yeah, that's pretty much the last line, right? Torunaga was like, soon Ishida will have complete control of the council and I'll be declared. So, yeah, I guess that is the outcome. They're just going to have full Ishido and Ochiba power going into episode 7.
Which is sad, but whatever. We needed a force, so otherwise the win's not going to feel as good. Moving over back to John Blackthorne and Torunaga's storyline. This is going to be the rest of the podcast, essentially. And what happens in the beginning is the direct aftermath of episode 5, where we're seeing what happened to the entire army and all the dead bodies that occurred because of the landslide and the earthquake. And naturally, Torunaga doesn't skip a beat or miss a moment to rally the troops and give one of the best speeches ever, right? He's always thinking of how he can leverage it to make like his political power better or his position a little bit better. And of course, he does it here. And I love his freaking, hi, hi, ho! Like, that's the best chant. They do that a couple times. It's just so good. It always gets me hype.
Absolutely, man. I get so hype when when he's pumping, he's winding that fist up. Damn right, I'm going to be screaming and pumping fists with him. So love that. He's just a man of the people. Gifts, the engine, a little fief, income of 600 koku. I still don't know how to reference that. I know they've put out a few numbers with koku, but I still don't know where to even gauge that. But it's a lot. And they're just raining presents down on the engine over here. So
why is he trying to leave, dude? He's showered in riches in this land. In the Japans.
Like, Japans, yeah. He's like, I don't know why. It's just, why the hell am I getting all this shit? So
but the title that he's given is Chief Admiral of the Kanto, and then he's also given back what was previously given to Omi as the leader of the cannon regiment, which I'm sure Omi's probably going to take it as a slight and then be all sketchy again because that's all he really does. But he actually didn't act that way this episode, and that's going to be something fun to talk about because I really think there's a chance that Yabu and Omi are just straight up forced to be on our side.
Yeah, it's looking like it.
Which is good.
Yeah, I mean, this next scene was the village cleaning up and Yabu's looking at papers and he's like, dude, our force is in shambles right now. And Omi's all pissed about, like, dude, I can't believe he gave the cannons over to John over there. And Yabu's like, dude, how are you even worried about that right now when look at all this shit? So I think you're right. They're just going to end up being on this side and being forced to not be able to be allies anywhere else. And they're just going to fight. And I hope their boys... Yabu is like talking kind of, he's literally talking bad about Torunaga, saying he was making bad moves earlier in the season. So I hope he actually like does respect him and want to serve under him. And that whole watching the sunset on that night bonded our souls. I hope that wasn't just like bullshit.
It's going to go one of two ways. Either like we're kind of talking about now, they're forced to be allies with Torunaga. They don't have any other choice. And in that case, like that's the best case scenario for me. Another possibility is they do a classic like storming of Osaka Castle and then Yabu gets a signal and he betrays and like that's like the last obstacle they need to overcome before the final battle. That could be like an episode 9 thing, which I would hate. The only thing that's supporting the potential for scenario 1 where they're actually good guys is later on, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, when Hiramatsu shows up and tells him about what's going on in Osaka, Torunaga gives Omi a chance to speak as like an advisor. It's like decent advice, I guess. It's basically just respecting him as a person in Torunaga's like household almost. And I'm hoping beyond hope that Omi's taking a little bit of pride and saying like, okay, maybe I can be on this side. That's the only way I can really see it, because otherwise it's been a lot of buildup for Yabu to just keep playing on the fence line to him not actually going to Ishido's side explicitly, which is scary for storytelling purposes because it seems like he could still betray him. But I just really hope that he doesn't betray Torunaga.
It's so hard to tell when he's like in the meeting giving his advice, because it is good advice for Torunaga. He's not giving him shitty advice to like benefit Ishido or his position. And yeah, that was the introduction to the Crimson Sky plan, which
is dope.
So cool. When he dropped that line and everybody, I was like, that's hype. And then Yabu's like, what is Crimson Sky? I'm like, I don't know, but it's awesome. I mean... And then they say it's one violent rush on Osaka. Got so hype. I was like, we're going to watch that at some point.
That right there is Dynasty Warriors. This is just what I'm picturing in my head.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Totally. And I would play as Mariko if I could play as one with the spear.
I'll be Rodriguez. Everybody. I'll come in with the backup.
Forgot about him. We haven't seen him in a while.
There's no way his face isn't shown again, right? Like, he's got to make another appearance.
I would like to believe so, yes.
He's going to be the reason. Him and Martin are going to rally the Portuguese to somehow be good and help out. That's the only way I can see that going.
Or JB's like, all right, not all Portuguese are bad.
Yeah.
High fives, Rodriguez.
Yeah. So it's like a character development moment for JB as well. So just, I already see it written from me. But before we're going to talk about this whole couple scenes where Torunaga is holding throne council outside again, where there's three conversations happen, there was a 2-second scene. And is there anything to take away from it with both Mariko and JB in different rooms, both praying? I feel like we haven't seen JB practicing religion, or Mariko for that matter, because she keeps saying how religious she is and she's always wearing the cross. But this is really the first time she's done anything religious in like 4 episodes. So I don't know, anything to take away, or is just there for the audience to remember that they are religious, even though they haven't been practicing their religion on screen?
If that was the point, was to show that Mariko actually does believe in her religion and does practice it, I needed that because like you were saying, she hasn't done anything. I didn't even know if she like fully believed in it, or if she would abandon it to help her other causes or whatever. So I know she hates when John talks bad about the Portuguese and saying they're only for profit, they don't care about you. I know that triggers Mariko, but I still didn't know. So this was, I guess this scene was kind of saying that, and that John...
But that's a good purpose of it, use of it, because it was only 10 seconds, you know?
Yeah, and John's a flirt, I guess. Because he was like, oh, I'm just going to go over here and we're not going to talk because we're not talking, but I'm just going to let her know that I'm sitting right here and interrupt her prayer. Such a weird scene, though. I totally agree.
Probably nothing to really comment more on it. Just worth pointing out that they are still practicing. But let's talk through these three scenes that happen before Hiramatsu comes in that council meeting that we've been hinting at happens. We just have Torunaga and Buntaro talking. Then Torunaga talking to JB and Mariko, and then JB leaves and it's just Mariko conversation. So it's the three pieces of it. And I'll just start off with the Buntaro piece, where I do like that Buntaro knows he's kind of an asshole and it keeps breaking like the honor code and he just keeps apologizing to everyone. That's fine. He's still an asshole. But he is basically told by Torunaga here, just divorce and like stop doing this bullshit, basically. And I think this slightly answers our debate that we had about how Buntaro feels about Mariko. I don't think he's like torture. Because he goes on to say that he thought she was ice at first, and after years of like protecting her and letting her live, thought she would melt. But that's never basically happened. It didn't come off to me that he was like, I hate her, I want to kill her, like, what can I do to just, like, torture? You know how that was kind of, I'm being hyperbolic about it, but that's kind of what we talked about last podcast.
No, totally. And when I saw this, I was thinking, yeah, this is more toward Luke's point in that Buntaro weirdly maybe did care about Mariko. Mm-hmm. And he says, I thought she would be happy when I spared her life, but she's been ice, and year after year, not once has the ice melted. So it's like he wants her to become a person again and not mm-hmm. want death, which makes me think he cares about her, but then he goes and fucking beats her. So I don't know. It's like the most confusing situation ever. But right. When Torunaga said, then divorce her, I was like, that was an option this whole time.
Yeah, right.
I thought that would like bring shame. Like divorce would just not be something accepted. If that's an option, fucking go through it.
But the issue is that if they get divorced, she's going to kill herself, because then she doesn't have to ask permission. I think.
Yes. Okay. So yeah. So he's weirdly trying to save her. But
that's what
not
I'm saying. It's kind
her?
Of like it's like a middle ground between both of our theories. But I'm still leaning a little bit towards my side, where he cares about her in his own weird, twisted way. And she's also technically, I mean, she is the mother of his son, which I guess has to have some value, but he's confusing. Buntaro's confusing. He's just, get him back in the battlefield. He's good for nothing else, and let's leave it at that.
Yeah, he gets spanked. Go isolate yourself from her for 7 days. It's like, that's such a funny punishment. It's like a elementary school punishment.
Yeah. Speaking of elementary school, we have a little bit of a, I don't know, mockery here once JB and Mariko come, and you can kind of feel that Mariko isn't being as professional as she probably should be as being Torunaga's translator. Like, she's adding her own input and like kind of filtering some of his answers. But after Buntaro leaves and they roll up, JB's whole purpose of being here is what he's been doing the last couple episodes. He's like, all right, I'm ready to go. Like, I can't help you further. I'm sorry. You gave me these gifts. Thank you. But I'd rather just have my ship. And then he goes on to say, well, I'll stay, but you got to let me ride and sail and basically fight the Portuguese on my own, which Torunaga was never going to go for. And I think that was the whole takeaway is he says, like, go get him laid because he's like wound up.
His plan, JB's plan, was pretty sound, I thought, when he was like, I'll go attack the black ship. Mm-hmm. That will make Portugal suffer, but that will also hurt Ono and
Kiama.
Kiama on the council. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, oh my God. So he's like linking it to his direct enemies, not just the common enemy. So I was like, oh, that makes sense. And then I don't think Marco really explained all of it. She just said he wants to attack the black ship. So I was a little upset. But yes, Marco is definitely slipping on purpose, I guess, a little bit. This episode, we get way more into it later on.
And tell me, what's her play? Like, what do you think it is? Is she just salty that Buntar is alive and she can't be with her crush? Is she annoyed at how JB's been acting recently? I can't really get a read besides just the tension that's clearly there.
I have no idea, man. I'm trying to figure out, like, rank her desires, like quests.
Kill herself, kill Buntaro, bang JB. Those are like her three.
Yeah, and ever since Buntaro came back, that's obviously when everything like started going shitty. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's just the tension of, I want to be around you, but I know I can't because there's already rumors going around about like we're never separated. Mm-hmm. And like, I also can't bring any more dishonor with Buntaro around because you saw last time how upset he got. So it's kind of like, I can't be with you fully, so I can't be around you at all because it makes me upset, kind of thing.
Yeah, I could see that. And I mean, it so clearly gets escalated by the later scene, so I guess we can save it for there. But after Torunaga kicks out JB and says, I'm done with this plan, it's stupid, whatever, go away, they have that conversation, and Torunaga is sussing out all of this tension and says, like, go with him as the translator. I don't think he is trying to facilitate them hooking up, unless he is. I don't know.
So this was weird. So the way I took this was that he's definitely suspects something between the two of them, right? Like, he doesn't know exactly what it is. So I was thinking, is Torunaga making a play right here where he's forcing Mariko, giving her an order, go in and watch as JB gets ridden into oblivion by Kiku? If she doesn't go in, that's because she likes John so much she can't watch him be with another woman. Mm-hmm. But if she does go in, then he's like, all right, she's more concerned about business. Like, I don't have to worry about this emotion. So maybe it was a test by Torunaga. And now by not going in, he knows that she like cares for him.
Mm-hmm.
John.
That again would be a great quick little scene at the beginning of the next episode where like Torunaga is getting paid by what's her name? I wrote it down. By Lady
Gin.
Yes, Lady Gin. If Torunaga's paying her and she gives the information, she didn't go in because they constantly say they feel like they're being watched. So that information is known by the tea house. And if they give that to Torunaga, that could be a fun plot point. So I'm actually hoping that you're right with that. Maybe it was a test to really find out where Mariko's heart is. Because then I feel like Torunaga might just be on Team JB. Like, okay, you guys clearly want to bang. Let me just order Buntaro to divorce. Everybody's happy. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe there's a world where it's happily ever after.
That's what I was thinking. He's like just trying to make John so happy. He's like, stay, dude. Yeah, I'll make you chief admiral. Look, you want Marco to be your wife? Or she can be your wife. Look, I'll divorce her. Like, he wants him to be happy.
Like I'm saying, that's good enough for me. I'm staying.
I know we talked about every episode, but again, John asked for his ship and his men, and Torunaga completely blew it off. Is this more and more evidence that his men are dead? Or
he actually, in this request, didn't mention his men for the first time. He really just said, I want my ship so I can sail against the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I also think they're long dead. Like, they've been dead for weeks and months, or whatever it's been. Yeah, they're dead.
Yeah. Okay. I've been waiting for that to finally come to light, mm-hmm. and then John be triggered and maybe like storm off or something like that. But if nothing comes of it, I'll be shocked.
Yeah. So,
and if they're actually alive, I'll be even more shocked.
Jimmy's been saying it since day one that they're dead, and I'm completely on that side where it makes for an easy tension point between JB and Torunaga down the line, which, why not? because I feel like things are going well right now for them. But anything else you want to bring up about the Hiramatsu arrival and talking about Operation Crimson Sky, which is just so, again, cool to name it that way. Because like Americans, we'd name it like Red Sky. Like, that's so lame. Crimson Sky. Like, you want to just rain blood down on Osaka now. That sounds fucking awesome.
Yeah, that was amazing. As soon as he dropped that, I'm like, hell yeah. The whole room just felt tense. The only other thing I got from this is Nagakato, his son, again, just seems like he's so young. He's showing so much emotion in this meeting where nobody else is. Like, he's punching the ground saying, like, what the hell? My father's so loyal. And everybody else is like speaking calmly and stuff like that. So again,
even Omi's being more mature.
Yeah. And this is like his first time in this council, I guess, probably. So,
yeah.
And yeah, when he straight up looks at Omi, Torinaga, that is, looks at Omi and says, like, what would you do, Omi? I was like, damn, that's a lot of that's a high honor. Just being straight up asked that from him.
Like, that's a genius plan if he's doing it on purpose. Because if you get close to Omi and make him really feel trusted and ingrained in this whole system, then Torinaga could be thinking that Yabu's going to be in too. Or at least that's a factor in keeping Yabu on this side if he's on Omi's good graces as well.
So I was going to ask you, who do you think is on Team Crimson Sky and who's on Team Anti-Crimson Sky?
It's important to note that the other part of Crimson Sky isn't just doing a coup and rushing Osaka, but it ends with Torinaga on the throne. So like that's a key piece of it. And so because of that, Torinaga's anti it. Like, he doesn't want the leadership role, but I think everybody there.
Yabu is the only one. Yabu and Omi.
Anti?
Yeah. And Omi, who was like, maybe do it. That's your only option. But why take the risk now when you can maybe do it a little bit down the road? Which, honestly, good advice. But yeah, Yabu's the only one who's like, dude, don't do it. It's suicide. Mm-hmm. We're killing ourselves. But yeah, the son, Buntaro, even, he's like, there's no time to waste. Like, we got to do this now. It seems like his people really do want to rush Osaka.
And after his speech at the end of the episode, anybody that would have been on the fence, like maybe Hiramatsu was on the fence, I think he's in, because Torinaga gave his public stamp of approval and saying we're doing this. Yeah, it's a good thought to see if it's actually going to cause any strife or if we're already past it and now it's just happening. So we're going to find out pretty early in the next episode. Also, what gets mentioned in this scene, which is very important and again plays into his speech at the end, is Torinaga has a half-brother, Nobutatsu, who they're going to recruit as an ally. It's said in this scene that even if he decides to join their army powers, it's not going to be enough, maybe, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. He decides that he's going to recruit him. I don't know how directly he's related to or who else he's related to, but it's his half brother. Don't know if that's going to be important, but it seems like he'll probably rally his troops next episode. So we're going to get introduced to another powerful general, which I always love, just getting these big figureheads of who's going to be the leaders, because it also adds the weight of potential more people that could die and make everything more emotional in the back half of this war, because there's going to be a Battle of the Bastards level of war, I think, where maybe it's not till the finale or maybe it's episode 9, but there's going to be some bodies. So we need a lot of people, a lot of powerful heads of households that are going to potentially die. And this seems like a good person to bring into the fold.
No, totally. Whenever he puts that armor on Torinaga, I get excited. So, you know, I know he's going to be donning that when they meet and talk. So I'm happy.
Okay, so now we step away for a tiny bit of the war talk, and we have Mariko going to barter at the tea house, and Lady Gin?
I think it's Gin.
So like bleach?
Bleach, or is that
Is that not the snake
Hunter
looking guy?
Oh,
the guy
with
the extension?
No.
Yeah. Come on.
You're right. I just think Gon's dad, right? That's awesome. Oh, no, it's with a G.
He's G-I-N-G. Like, he has a G. Ginj, whatever.
Makes sense.
But she's holding her own in this scene from like an acting point of view. I thought she was battling with Mariko pretty well. I think Fuji's in this scene as well. She's giving a little side eye every once in a while. She's just so charming. I love Fuji. Just sprinkle her in wherever you can, because she didn't have any talking lines here. But I don't know. I don't really have any takeaways from this besides Lady Kiku is like one of the most sought out courtesans in all of Japan. And this is like an actual powerful tea house.
Yeah, so the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, that was pretty cool. You know, it was honestly more comic relief than anything because there were some funny lines. Then I rewatched it and I was like, they're really focusing on the cups a lot. Like, what's going on? And then searched something real quick, and turns out the scene a lot more was going on than leads. So right off the bat, when they're looking at the cups, Fuji says like, oh, like, I'm sorry, they're really bad cups. Like, so much got destroyed in the earthquake. Mm-hmm. I wish we could, you know, have more. While that kind of might be true, it's so common to downplay your wealthiness as like a bargaining tool. Because if they pulled out like the best shit, she's going to be like, dude, you can afford so much. So they're already playing mind games just by silverware or cups that they're selecting. So that was one
thing. That's pretty cool.
And then whenever they actually like grab the cups and like put them down, whenever they put the cups down, they were like making a declaration or like making a bid. It was more like they said like moving chess pieces, because they would like put the cup down, say a price. The other one would like, you know, have the cup, say something, mm-hmm. change the subject a little bit, and then put it down and say their price. And
so it's then like an emphasis, kind of like a.
Yeah, they're like trading chess pieces, because they're like saying, I forget what it started out with, but when, you know, she drops the 500, Mario says like, yeah, right. Like, I'm not trying to buy all the tea houses. I want one night. And then Gin goes on to say like, oh, well, maybe 400. I want Laura Torinaga to have a good night. That was one move, you know, give me 400 because it's for Laura Torinaga. Mm-hmm. Marco's like, oh, you were mistaken. It's not for Torinaga. It's actually for the Barbarian or Anjin. So that was like another chess move. And she puts her cup down and says like, you know, 200. And then finally, again, because she knows of the rumors of how Marco and John are never separated, she's kind of saying like, oh, it's not blackmail outright, but she's saying like, oh, I heard rumors.
Yeah,
give me the 300. And Mario goes, you know what? Like, I'll settle on the 300. So it was
a lot
whole,
going on.
It was a whole back and forth and like battle of the wits almost. So I can't believe I completely missed that basically the first time. And then I come back and think, thank goodness people laid it out on the internet. It made me appreciate this scene. And like you were saying, both the actors, I mean, Lady Gin was, she was killing it with the little nuances of slightly smiling to slightly smiling less when Mario says something smartassy. So it was amazing. I really, really did love this scene.
Yeah. I love that you saw that online. That would have just went right over my head. But that just goes to show you how much they care about this show. Like, this show is such a love project. And I know Hiroyuki Sanada is like involved with like the production. Like, I hope that more shows are made like this, where you can just feel the passion coming out of these every single scene, these minute little scenes where I had one bullet point for that scene and you just broke it down beautifully. It's like, this show could be studied. It's so good. I just want more quality like this coming out, because the internet's loving it. We're loving it more than anything. Like, these are the type of shows we should be making in 2024. You know what I mean?
It makes me want to go back to last episode. We were talking about when the four seats the council were meeting. It was like so clunky. Sugiyama started coughing at one point, and Ishido just looks at him, and we were like, what the hell is going on? It makes me want to go back and see if there was like underlying tones and themes and intentions behind that and everything. So this show is exactly what you said. It's a love project, and you can definitely tell.
That just triggered something in my head. Like, why was he coughing? Is that just gone now?
No idea. No idea.
That will never get explained. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I don't know what that one was for, but anyway,
exactly.
Let's keep going with more of this storyline, where we get a quick second of Kiku explaining the plan to Omi, who is just mad with just anger and jealousy of JB, whether it's because of Torinaga's gifts and all of his blessings, or now it's his literal girl that he's in love with. So I hope this doesn't boil into Omi doing something irrational, but it doesn't seem like he's that type of person like Nagakado is. So I hope it doesn't play out in that way. But at the same time, there needs to be some sort of payoff with Kiku and Omi's relationship. So it's like, what is the payoff truly going to be between them? And the only thing I'm still hanging my hat on is that maybe Lady Kiku is still a spy for somebody in Osaka, whether it's Ishido or Uchiba. Like, it could be either of them still. Like, I don't know. Like, Kiku feels like she has some part to play in this, and I just don't know what it is.
Definitely. And it's interesting, because when she tells Omi all this and then goes to kiss him, he actually turns away. He doesn't kiss, because he's obviously so frustrated with everything that's happening. Later on, you know, after the whole night at the brothel at the tea house when Kiko like basically escorts John back. Omi hears everything that she's saying about John, like, oh, like, come back, I'll count the moments. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't like that either. So I'm like now expecting him to almost cut Kiku off next episode, or at least not be like totally in love with her, or he's going to flip on John and do something crazy towards him.
Agreed. It's got to be one of those two things. And if she does the first thing and gets cut off by him, that could be a way for them to organically expose her being a spy, because she's going to be freaking out like, oh my God, I need to get back in somehow, and being like extra risky maybe. But I don't see it going any other way besides one of those two. And I don't want Omi to flip on John. That just doesn't feel like how his character has been going so far, his character arc.
I feel like it wouldn't be smart, and he's smart enough not to do that.
Exactly, exactly. Well said. I have a couple notes here, but we can really just talk through the entire night of Mariko and JB and Lady Kiku. Everything that happens here, my biggest takeaway is just that they're in love. Mariko and JB are in love. And Lady Kiku clocked this, and she tried to help. I don't know if she was trying to help to get more leverage on Mariko and JB, or if she was just truly saying how she sees another woman in pain and she wants to help. Like, maybe she is a good person, and I'm reading way too into this, and she is just trying to, you know, show that this tea house is experimental and like it's more liberal and like and progressive and will allow them to all hook up together if that's what she truly wants. Because in that case, Kiku's just like a good person, and it feels like there's not really room for good people in this time.
Yeah. I think she was trying to trick them into actually doing it, and then them having that knowledge and being able to use it again as blackmail. Because I don't know if it's because I just watched and you just watched Blue Eyed Samurai, but like, mm-hmm. they're in this tea house and I'm like, dude, so many eyes are on you right now. Mm-hmm. Like, they keep saying this is a private room. No way this is private. If I were John and I was in this tea house, I would melt like butter. Like, the way Kiku just walks out, her voice is so pleasant. Mm-hmm. She just tries to make you feel comfortable. She has to say all the right things. She pours the sake pour so funny. Mariko saying how it's a studied art that people study for years. Please compliment her on it. And he's like, you pour very well. Like that. Mm-hmm. That's what he pops out with.
The laugh out loud moment for me was when she asked through Mariko, like, oh, are women like this in your country? And he goes, no, nothing like this. Like, they're way worse. And then she says, he prefers women from his own country in Japanese. Like, she's just being a little jealous right there.
Totally, totally. I had that as like one of the big mistranslations that she does this episode. And it's because I feel like she doesn't want to give any satisfaction to Kiku right there. And she doesn't want to give her the compliment that John just said. She's well put together and inquisitive. And Marco's mm-hmm. like, I'm not fucking telling her that. Fuck that.
It's so funny how much power she has over everything he does. And this is really the first episode she's kind of flexing it.
Oh, totally. Totally. Super weird scene real quick. It was weird, but also inquisitive and cool. And I only used inquisitive because John just used that in the show. But when the handmaid or whatever she's called, Hannah, the assistant comes in and takes that away, Kiku just teaches her real quick. Was that like a flex? Was they planned that out on purpose to show John that who he is with right now is like an intelligent individual?
Like the level of esteem that this tea house brings, like with its people and how they cultivate people to become professionals, maybe?
I don't know. It just seemed like you're putting on a performance for John, right? You want him to be happy tonight. Like, why would you like sidebar real quick just to teach unless there was a point behind it? I just didn't really know what it was. I didn't know if she
like
was
maybe they were saying like nothing but perfection is like allowed here. That could be part of it too.
The whole thing she said was like presence is most keenly felt in absence. And I was like, that doesn't relate to anything, does it? So I just took it as she's teaching. That's just what they do over there in the willow world.
It could have been symbolism for the fact that she's saying to like Mariko, like, if you don't come with us, you're going to feel more hurt than if you stay, because you're going to feel the loneliness. I don't know.
I was just trying.
Yeah.
No, you're doing exactly what I was trying to do, and I couldn't find anything. So that is a better idea than I could have assembled. Mm-hmm. So if anybody listening has any idea of what they got from that little teaching scene, please let us know.
Yeah, there's a lot of symbolism probably going on. One of the questions I had from this scene, and I can't really think of a reason why, but when they're doing the whole sensual talk where Kiku's having her Mariko translate like her true feelings almost to Butter. JB back and forth, why did that trigger a sad flashback of like her family? Because that's what I couldn't really think about. What was causing that? What I thought was happening was she was realizing like she's truly just in love, but it seemed like it connected to her past, and I could have missed why that was.
So I think you had the right idea. The way I took it is Mariko was losing herself. Kiku was basically seducing the two of them together by having Mariko say all this out. And she wanted to lose herself and go and join John and Kiku in the other room. But I got the flashbacks as her centering herself as like the eightfold fence and being like, hey, remember this. Remember why you're here. And she's like, I can't do that. I can't go with John.
That's it. 100%. The next scene that happens, like, kind of plays off on that. Where, so I guess, like, after the whole, you know, awkward morning, I don't know if you want to bring anything up with the awkward morning, nothing scene happens. Later that night, I think it's that night, that Torunaga and Mariko talk again, and they bring up her connection to Uchiba, but they also talk about Jinzai, her father's plan, which was to marry her off so that she would be away from all of this. And goes on to say, like, one day return to finish it. So maybe you're right. Like, it's kind of like keeping her resolve. I guess it does link directly back to the Eightfold Fence and like really showing you that Mariko, her whole life is based around what happened to her family. And it's centering her in almost a way where John's a symbolism for like freedom, like he talked about earlier in this season. She can't let herself succumb to that. So I actually like that reading that you got on that, because that cleared everything up. That makes a ton of sense. I could not for the life of me thinking, it's like, this is happy time, why are we being all sad? And now it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, are you trying to make yourself not happy? And turns out kind of like she's just recentering herself.
Exactly. And I hope that Torunaga's conversation with her, instead of making it more about, I deserve to be punished and I should die, when he tells her that, what, you didn't know the plan the whole time was to keep you safe for your father, like he wanted this. I hope that turns that into the motivation where now she's going to be, I want to live for myself. That seems like an almost complete character arc if the next episodes play into that idea. And it could just end with the symbolism of her agreeing to be with John and like letting go of all of this, everything that you're holding on to. So I feel like there's so much room for that to play out in a poetic way that you just completely convinced me that that was the reason.
Yeah. And that scene where Torunaga tells Mariko about her father's plan, that was super powerful, because it just goes to show the issues that the culture could have with their etiquette and what's said without being said and what's supposed to be assumed, and how there is gray area in what is to be assumed. Like, Torunaga never talked to Mariko about this, but Torunaga knew that this was Akechi Jinsei's plan the entire time, was to send her away. But they never talked about it. Mm-hmm. And he assumed that Mariko knew, but she had no idea. She's like, why the fuck? She said right before that, like, my father should have done a better job marrying me. That is just when the bubble burst and the light bulb went off for him. And he's like, surely you must have known. And yeah, totally. Man, the way she just fell to her knees, she was distraught. But this, exactly what you were saying, is giving her another fight, right? Like Torunaga says, like, your war's not over. Like, you're still, now you have a greater service or something greater to serve. So I loved the scene for as much pain as it brought her.
Yeah. And that even plays into her conversation in episode one with Fuji, where the whole idea was to give her purpose. Like, you can still have purpose. And she in herself thinks her purpose is to die all the way up until this point, where now she's reinventing that purpose. And it's just funny because Torunaga forgets that he's just the smartest guy ever and knows everything, that other people don't know everything, you know? So that kind of gets shown here too. But just a really important episode for building out both Uchiba and reinventing Mariko's relationship with JB and herself. So all of these scenes really play out to like a good end point where we can finally just, everything's established. Let's start sprinting to a badass battle that people are going to be talking about online forever. And I think that's like all the pieces are almost in place. Maybe one more episode, which would be next one of episode 7 of getting Torunaga's final allies in place, like his half brother. Like, I could see that being it, but it really could like end with them rolling up to Osaka being in view, and then like that's the end of episode 7, and then 8, 9, 10 is just about like the war and the resolution. That would be a fun way to really end the season, because yeah. Operation Crimson Sky is fucking happening.
It's in the front of my mind. It's the only thing I'm thinking about. And we keep saying, like, the show's so amazing. You can have a great episode, like a quote-unquote action-packed episode, without there being any action scenes. Example, episode 6, really, really good. But, I mean, you said, give me some action, right? You teased us with a little bit of it. The choreography looked amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Even, keep wanting to say Hashimoto, but it's not. All right. Hiramatsu. Hiramatsu, the little slice on horseback. That was a little tease. Give me more of that. It looks so good. So I'm so excited for it mm-hmm. whenever it's coming. And it's going to be such a bloodbath.
They're saving it all. Like you're saying, they're giving us teases. There's just going to be like probably 45 minutes straight of just battle, which I can't freaking wait. That's going to be so badass. Here's a question I have for you just off the top, because we're pretty much done the episode, because we already talked about Torunaga's speech at the very end after they find out that Sugiyama was murdered. And Torunaga knows, okay, like they're going to do everything in their power to just basically outlaw me. So he says, let's do Operation Crimson Sky. And you kind of zoom out and you see there's still a huge part of the army that is still good to go, which I was curious about. I kind of wanted some gauge into how many people that they lost. And they said earlier in this episode, thousands. But the army still looks formidable. When you went out to his hi, hi, ho thing, like you saw how big the army that's still there is, but they definitely going to need more if they're going to be storming the capital. But with that in mind, because I'm pretty much done with my whole episode review, I just wanted to ask you, through 6 episodes, and we'll do this in a more formalized way later in the season, who are your top 4 favorite characters, just off the cuff, in order? Because I'm curious to see if we're in the same spot.
Honestly, Mariko and Torunaga are like vying for 1 and 2.
Okay.
Like, I want to say Torunaga just because his presence is immense. But Mariko has done so much more, and she's amazing. She can fight. She's smart. She's the translator. So I want to say, like, she's 1 and Torunaga 2. Probably John is 3, and then maybe Yabu, because he's amazing. Okay. Like, low-key want to say Fuji, but I think Yabu is a little bit more going on.
My top 4 is definitely going to change once we get more screen time for some of these characters, but I'm sitting at Torunaga 1. I think JB is a close 2. Then I had Fuji and then Mariko. But like four of them are just like up there. I'm happy we have differences there, because I really wanted to ask Jimmy his opinion as well. I'll have him give it at the top of next podcast. But that's good. It means like I'm seeing all across the internet people like standing Fuji, Mariko, Ochiba, just saying the women of this show are incredible. And I totally agree, because I'll have Ochiba in my top 5 already, and she's barely been in it. And she has so much room to shoot up to the top, like if she is that formidable rival against Torunaga. So I just like how it could be anybody. I could have sworn you're going to put JB as 1, because you've been riding for him since episode 1, and I was a little hesitant, which I now completely regret, because he can do no wrong. But I love JB. I think he's amazing.
I think he's great, but he's 1, killed Gardner. 2, Mariko's just been shining, man. She's been going through so much, but yet she shows that she has so much inside of her. I love her so much. She's amazing. Let me ask you a question now, though. This is more theory related. So at this last scene, Torunaga saying, you know, I never wanted anything. I never wanted honors. But if the traitors are putting the heir's life in danger, I have no choice but to go fight. It's going to be Crimson Sky. Earlier on this episode at the council, Sugiyama was saying, there is no evidence of this threat on the heir's life. Like, where are you coming up with this? Do you think that that whole rumor was started by Lady Ochiba to force Torunaga to make the first move? Because Torunaga, this whole time, he's saying, let your enemies make the first mistake. Like, that's why I've won all my battles, because I never had to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
By making this rumor, do you think Lady Ochiba is purposely manipulating Torunaga to make the first move and forcing him to act, and therefore maybe making him make a mistake?
I think that's step 2 of the reason she's doing it. The first reason being she wants to unite the council as her puppets, like force them to think that Torunaga is going to kill the heir, unite, vote him out, and then she has control, and then make it so that Torunaga comes to war. I don't think she's doing it. Like, I think it comes in that specific order because she doesn't technically have the power yet. Like, still, she doesn't have the power. All she does is have sway over Ishido. But now, once they establish Lord Ito and then the fifth councilman to replace Sugiyama, she will truly have the power. And I think that's the goal. And then once we get the power, we worry about killing Torunaga.
I gotcha. Yeah, I mean, that's what they've been saying this whole time. Get the council mm-hmm. together so we can sentence him to death. So I guess, yeah, she's just trying to get that in motion. I mean, we were talking about how smart she is and how she's saying, oh, Ishido and the rest of the council, they have no idea who they're going up against. He's so smart. I just feel like she, after stewing on this for all this time, is so intelligent and probably thinking out a plan. And I would just love her. Like we were talking about, she's barely been in it. And she's already like top five character argument.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I could see that just like putting her over the top and just as an excellent, excellent character. But she's already amazing. So
she is. And just this is funny to think about, too, because we basically didn't even talk about her. Jimmy brought her up for a second in the flashback episode two where we saw the Taiko dying. Like her being all cocky and like with like a smirk makes so much more sense now because she is this type of political savvy person that's thinking more than just there to be the concubine. So like, I think on a rewatch, I'll pay attention to her in that flashback, which will be cool because she was already kind of being shown as like with that little cocky smirk that I just feel like shows competence for her.
Oh yeah. She's amazing. I'm going to love the rewatch. We're talking about every scene having so much detail. I'm sure going back, it's going to be so rewarding.
Are we good? I feel like we crushed that.
Yeah, I think that's it.
All right, we'll get Jimmy's opinions on that whole episode and maybe his top five initial characters at the top of our next recording. But for now, that's going to do it for us, guys. We love this show. Shogun's tomorrow and today, and whatever Jimmy always says, this show's the shit. I love talking about it. If you missed any of the previous recordings, everything's housed at BingeTownTV.com, or you could just search BingeTown TV anywhere you can find podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, we're there. We're everywhere. So not going to go over the spiel again. I think we talked it out.
Crimson Sky, baby.
Awesome. Only four left. So for now, we are BingeTown TV, and thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.